I like young people to know that they are extremely powerful. So I'm one person, but I always had this positive idea about my role. And you cannot let anyone tell you what limitations are there. So you shouldn't feel limited by anyone telling you this is as far as you can go and this is what you can do. I think only you know about that. And I think you start step by step. When I did the first case, I learned some things. Then it was the next case. When it came the time to learning, learn with all your might, because that's gold. It's a moment in life when you have the time to actually do that. Get informed, people that are into Googling everything. Open up your searches, go out there, learn in a different way. And I guess the book was about giving hope, because I realized how much we could do together. If a person can manage to argue blah, 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 and make a major impact in the way we are understanding treaties and human rights or others, imagine what could be if every single person is in its own place, in its own field, contributing with that alertness and synced in the same way. I believe that the ordinary people are the ones that are bringing the changes here. I believe that the communities that are gathering together, for example, I'm seeing that in this country around the protection of rivers, is the communities that are going to mark the change. It's not going to come from up, it's going to come always from down up. And that means all of us, we have all a role. So to the young people, I would say, you have the right of joy and you have the right to be happy. And working for the protection of what we love the most will make you happy. So get into a positive mindset, learn all what you can, be part of things that make you feel positive. You will see how you will find your way. And there is no place for feeling disempowered. This is the moment where you should feel very powerful, because it's us who are going to make the future of this earth.
Monica Faria Tinta is a British Peruvian barrister specializing in public international law. She has been called one of the most daring, innovative, and creative lawyers in the United Kingdom, and was shortlisted for Barrister of the Year at the Lawyers Awards 2020 and at Chambers and Partners UK Bar Awards in 2023 for her work in addressing climate change and environmental degradation. In 2020, she acted before the Constitutional Court of Ecuador in the Los Cedros case, the first rights of nature case in the world. In September 2022, her work as counsel secured a win in the Torres Strait Islanders case, a landmark moment in which the UN Human Rights Committee found a sovereign state responsible for the first time in history for lack of action in addressing climate change. She is the author of A Barrister for the Earth, 10 Cases of Hope for Our Future. Monica Faria Tinta, welcome to One Planet Podcast and the Creative Process.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So we welcome you on the show, also on the occasion of your recently published book, A Barrister for the Earth. And before we delve into our conversation, I believe you've selected a passage to share with our listeners.
Yes, this is an extract from my book, A Barrister for the Earth, 10 Cases of Hope for Our Future. And it reads as follows. You cannot predict the seasons any longer, observed one of my clients, an indigenous Melanesian inhabitant of the Torres Strait Islands. His reality had become dystopic. Life on Boigo Island, the most northerly inhabited island in the Torres Strait, close to Papua New Guinea, had been determined by the seasons since ancestral times. That certainty is now gone. To make matters worse, every year a piece of the island is being eaten by the sea. The Torres Strait Islands are sinking, and it is because of climate change. It is not just in the Torres Strait. On the opposite side of the world, on the northernmost peninsula of South America, in a land of water scarcity, waterways are diverted to extract coal from riverbeds, all to power Western civilization.
And that's one of the areas of the world in which you've worked on their behalf. And I think that that gives our listeners a good glimpse into your work. I'm just wondering, you know, why at this time did you decide to write the book and document these 10 cases for hope? You know, how is it important for you to reach audiences outside of legal frameworks?
Well, to be honest, the structure of the book in a way goes chronologically from the first cases I started advising on in environmental law when I arrived to the bar to more recent cases and breakthroughs. But I opened the book with the case of a coal mine in Colombia I worked on during COVID, during the lockdown. And the reason I wrote the book, I think in a way, was out of a personal reaction to that. Usually as a lawyer, you are involved only to the extent that the case lasts and you are instructed. And then, you know, it's the next case. But the case deeply affected me. It made me angry, to be honest, to see the level of destruction that we were experiencing in the world. And above all, what really disturbed me was the connection of that destruction with my own reality and even the sense of becoming even complicit with that, because we tend to think that these terrible things sometimes are happening far away from us in the West. But what the stories in my book taught me and my clients taught me was that the destruction in the Amazon, let's say, because of gas exploration, was deeply connected where I was living, because that gas was reaching the UK. In the case of a coal mine, the devastation that was so extensive and so shocking, and companies playing God by even changing the course of rivers to be able to mine more coal. But the scary thing is that I understood that to an extent that destruction was the premise of our current model of our current civilization, because that coal apparently was needed. So there was a demand for that in our world somewhere else. So that was the shocking bit that I wanted to share and to reflect and to see how we could work to have a different world.
Indeed. And so your book, it's really inspiring, David and Goliath story. You've been called one of the most daring, innovative and creative lawyers in the United Kingdom. You know, as a leading climate barrister, your book shares these 10 legal battles that give hope for the protection of the planet. But let's face it, coming up against the fossil fuel industry and, of course, our demand for it, and oil and gas and coal and extractive practices, it's a challenging arena in which to score points. And we know that they pay, you know, hundreds of millions to advertising firms, lobbyists, other persuaders and influencers to keep polluting the planet and doing business as usual. So what drives you to take the fossil fuel industry and its cohorts on?
I think it's a love for humanity. And I think it's also beyond humanity's love for beyond the human. I think in my work, I have come to understand the fact that we are not separated from nature. We are one with nature. It has been a very interesting voyage for me because I have indigenous background. My ancestors come from a beautiful area of the world in Arequipa, Peru. It's a Colca Canyon area where we have the deepest canyon in the world and birds like the condors who live there. In ancient thinking of my background, of my ancestors, we are of a mountain. In fact, the mountain is called Hualca Hualca and she's female. And the reason why people consider her an ancestor is because the water of this extinct volcano comes down onto the earth and then irrigates all the fields and helps producing what people need to survive. So in this untraditional way of seeing life, they don't see the mountain as something sterile and devoid of life. It's all the opposite. It is alive and it is an ancestor. So I realized when I was writing the book that I was also a daughter of the Hualca Hualca. And I think this has been something that has my own identity and my own thoughts, and why is it that I could understand the indigenous people's perspectives and I didn't feel that they were coming from something completely weird. Rather, it made a lot of sense. I think this background helped me to connect, but in connecting, rediscovering also some very important truths, because being one with nature is not just indigenous people's thinking, but in the West, we have had critical philosophers, biologists, that have taught us exactly the same because they have observed that in nature. For example, one of these philosophers is Spinoza, who explained that we were one with nature. And I think that the biologists from the beginning of making really major discoveries like von Humboldt to more recent biologists studying biodiversity in our world equally have taught us how valuable a small ant may be, how everything is interconnected. So I think my work is part of this valuable unity and the world being really an organism. And we cannot be separated. So often it happens that the moment we separate humanity from the earth, from the place where our brains have developed and where we have to become biologically humans, the moment that fragmentation creates this world that we are seeing now, which is in need of serious repair.
Indeed. And it's so moving. I mean, we're audio, so people can't see the emotion welling up in your face as you speak about how we are all part of nature and your own background and in indigenous beliefs. So your legal arguments, they often hinge on evidence from ecosystems that to many of us are invisible, like deep sea zones or high elevation forests. And there is this invisible toll of pesticides on birds and insects. What role does the unseen or the ignored play in your litigation? And how can we convince a court to value what it cannot directly observe?
Yeah, actually, you are picking up on a very interesting notion. It's true. The notion of the unseen. One of the clear examples of that was the example of the cloud forest that I acted for. It was even unseen for me because I acted on this case at a distance. So I never set foot in the cloud forest in Los Cedros. But that didn't stop me from being able to act for the forest. And when I saw the forest, was through all the scientific studies that have already showed, demonstrated, documented the biological value of this cloud forest, Los Cedros. So how did that happen? I was invited to produce amicus curiae. It was a forest that was facing destruction by a project that intended to mine gold. This forest was extremely sensitive. Why? Because number one, it was a untouched forest. And second, it was a forest near the equator line, which that it has a lot of richness in biodiversity and a lot of endemic species, both flora and fauna. And in fact, what was unbelievable is that in a small patch of earth, you could find a species that didn't exist anywhere else in the world, not even a little bit farther in the same forest. So that's the level of diversity. And most of it was still unknown to us. So most of the forest has not been yet studied. But what we know and what has been studied was extremely special. And among species, there were fungi, orchids, the spectacle bear, frogs of all sorts. You know, when I dive into the evidence of all that existed, I started seeing it. And one of the judges of the court said, after the judgment was delivered, was that he had been quite surprised that before granting the license for the mining project, he was surprised that the government had not made any assessments or had taken the time to consider the scientific value of the place. So in court, the state never presented in its defense for its decision any assessment that they may have carried out. And that was a surprise. It's, you know, that's a moment of seeing where you make an assessment and clearly understand what is at stake. What are you about to destroy? And then you make your decision. So that, I think, was quite crucial. And then it teaches us, yes, our ignorance, our lack of paying attention and how important it is to obviously have the proper mechanism for any assessment, but also our capacity to see, our capacity to pay attention. So that example of that forest taught me that. And I learned a great deal. For 2 weeks, I was completely immersed in that world. And the hearing was the most surreal story for me because it was very long. A lot of interveners were scientists that were showing evidence of different species. And so watching all of this, being part of all of this, it was special because what you had in court was the spectacle bear, the monkeys, the fungi, the orchids. You know, these were the parties. It was all of this forming the forest. This was obviously a case that I was under a specific provision of the Constitution of Ecuador, which actually acknowledges rights of nature. So it was not from an anthropocentric perspective, but the case was to assess the value of this forest from the ecocentric perspective. So that was wonderful.
Indeed. And you mentioned their value. Often we're just seeing the forest, as to the trees we depend on, the value we can extract, we're looking to measure by how we can use it, whether it should be saved. But I do believe that this sense of awe that you describe could awaken responsibility. Like in Los Cedros, you know, scientists testified to the forest's extraordinary biodiversity, its mystery, its evolutionary uniqueness. And so in court, does wonder matter? How do you tap into that wonder? Can law be moved by beauty, by mystery, and the rare and the sacred? And how do you bring emotions into it to inspire the courts to care and, by extension, humanity to care? You know, we talk about the unseen. Sometimes this biodiversity, obviously, it's not a human populated area. So the measurements haven't really been conducted. And so can resist measurement. And even us going in can further put our footprint on its biodiversity. So how do you awaken that awe, and how do we better value those things that resist measurement?
So thinking about value, first of all, I think we have to stop thinking in monetizing terms. There's a tendency to even now assess how much a forest like that in terms of money may equalize to. I think that's a very wrong approach, because nature is not a commodity. That's something that Ralph Emerson said so long ago, and he's so right. I think that we need to approach things in a completely different way. I mean, a famous biologist called E.O. Wilson used this beautiful image, a very powerful one, saying, when we are wiping out these irreplaceable worlds, it is like burning Renaissance paintings to cook dinner. And I think he really put it very well. That's what is happening. Now, you asked me about courts and how do you introduce this beauty in advocacy when it comes to advocacy in a courtroom. Well, a lot of what an advocate does, a specialist appearing in courts, is about storytelling. So storytelling is not something that is separate from the process of lawmaking. I mean, the best lawyers are the best storytellers, because it really has to capture the imagination. It has to capture the attention. And you have to be able to say something very convincingly, and also put it in terms very simple to grasp. So the more complex, the more simple it has to be, the argument. And I think that's something that happened during this process, let's say in Los Cedros case, because it appeared that there were a lot of layers of argument. There were some very simple questions that the court had to ask itself. And then you build the evidence alongside that. But I think that these aspects of beauty is a constant in cases this sort, not that they are not technical issues that can be quite heavy in environmental law cases, but nevertheless, one should never lose what is really at the stake because of technical aspects and get lost on that. So, for example, when the Tribunal for the Law of the Sea had to decide how to answer a couple of questions that they had to produce an opinion on, I remember I was instructed by WWF to prepare submissions for this tribunal in the context of the advisory proceedings on the law of the sea and climate change. And I remember I was sitting here, exactly where I am, where I'm talking to you, and I was looking through very early in the morning, so at 5 a.m., the light was already quite beautiful, and a bird came nearby, and just the flow, how it felt, all of a sudden I realized, how do you define marine environment? You see, people sometimes think an environment is something like a thing, like that. But I argued that marine environment is part of what is accepted now in the law of the sea, really is composed by living organisms in the sea. So it's not something devoid of life, it's actually alive. So the way I opened the submissions was recognizing the value of the marine environment, of these living organisms, on themselves. So it's not for what they provide us. It's not for any role serving humanity. And if you see whales or you see glaciers, it would be completely silly to think that they exist because they provide something to us. It's just nonsense. It just is, and we are part of it. And it makes us joyful. Because you use the term awe. And in the book, I reflect a little bit on that and how psychologists have studied our need for wild awe, to be wondered by place in the world. And when we look at the stars, why is it that it makes us happy? It's because we have developed, we have evolved and become human beings in the midst of all of this. So in other words, courts are formed by people as well. Judges are human. And therefore, they can very well understand all these concepts that are so fundamental to understand, particularly at this critical moment. And just to finish here, one of the comments that one of the judges of the Constitutional Court of Ecuador made when he was interviewed on Los Cedros, he said that it moved him to see that so many people had come together to protect the forest and creating music and creating art. And they were developing an entire campaign around that. And it was really very well done. I mean, the expressions, at some point he saw that and he said it was moving. So he felt that the court was aware that the world was watching. And to see that people cared, it was as well something moving. So I think that art and culture in how we love and want the protection of these irreplaceable wars is also very important in those processes.
Yeah, we really do need to, as you say, move beyond property and utility to a more humble and respectful relationship with nature. In Silent Spring, Rachel Carson tried to give voice to the non-human, to the birds whose songs were vanishing, and you speak for forests and oceans and species at risk. But you're also right that the courts are still deeply anthropocentric. Of course, Ecuador, as you mentioned, that's a rare country in the world that recognizes earth law and their constitution. So do you envisage a future where legal standing is granted to ecosystems or species without requiring a human claimant? And what would it take to get there?
I think we are living a revolution about that. First of all, legal personality has to do with two aspects. On the one hand, is the aspect of being a subject of rights, acknowledged in the law as a subject of rights. That's the substantive aspect. And the second is the procedural rights, to be able to exercise a procedural right to act in your own right in courts. That's a procedural right. So legal standing is connected to the substantive rights, but it is not all. It starts with being a recipient of those rights. So some systems may have first only the acceptance of the substantive rights, perhaps not procedural standing yet, like a child, for example, right? But other systems may be evolving to have both. And so what have been seen recently is Ecuador is the only legal system with a constitution set up that who can act for nature is anyone. So anyone can actually bring a case arguing that the rights of nature are being violated. Now, in Colombia, the process has been a bit different. There is not a constitution. There is no substantive law that says nature has rights. But courts have developed this evolution by basically having a case where they analyze the matter and asserted the rights of that river. So they have had cases concerning rivers, concerning forests like the Amazon. In the case of the river, the first case was the Atrato case. And it was really all flowing from the analysis of the court. The court drew perhaps from Colombia international obligations, mentioned soft law like the Agenda 21st, etc. It was quite interesting how, in order to protect the communities living along the banks of the river Atrato, the court saw that it was the best way was to actually recognize rights to the Atrato, because automatically that will also protect the rights of people. Because what was happening was heavy metal contamination in the river, and people rely on the river for everything. So the contamination was eaten by the fish, and people ate the fish mainly. And then they ended up having this heavy metal contamination in their own bodies. So the moment that you recognize that the river has the right to be free from pollution, the right to restoration, etc., there were four rights acknowledged, the moment that you resolve the problem also for the community. And the community, they all became guardians. So they elected people that would be in charge of implementing a plan together with the government to ensure those rights of the river. From that moment on, there's been a major revolution around the world. We have In Spain, the Mar Menor also has acknowledged rights via specific legislation. We have seen in New Zealand via a treaty, it has happened the same with the river. In Peru, there has been both via jurisprudential developments, like the recent River Marañón in the Amazon has been acknowledged rights. Two, even the Lake Titicaca. So we have had the Nepal glacier as well being declared as having rights. And then you may wonder, is this always linked to indigenous peoples? Is it always the need that there may be the indigenous peoples around nature to have this recognition? I say no, because what has been happening in England, for example, is that we are having communities deeply interested in protecting nature now because it's a major biodiversity crisis. So I had the opportunity to act advising a community in Lewes, which is in the south of England, to protect a river. And the community developed a charter, which is recognizing rights to the river. And this working together with the local council. So in England right now, it's taking place a major revolution with rivers. First, the River Ouse, which is in Lewes. Local councils are getting active. Then the River Wye now has a voice for the river in its own meetings by the council when they have to determine matters that may affect the river. Then the River Severn, which is the longest river in Britain and the most important, the communities also want to develop a protection for the river, acknowledging the rights of the river. And I am advising on that case. And there's other examples in Scotland and also down in Hampshire, where they want to protect the river and shock streams, also all based on an ecocentric approach. So I want to emphasize the following. It's not granting rights. It is acknowledging inherent rights, just like in the case we did with humans, because when we had the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, it was not a granting of anything new. What was simply happening was recognizing the inherent right of dignity, right of life of human beings. And what we are doing now is acknowledging that nature has also inherent rights.
Yes, and I'm glad to see that those movements in the UK of acknowledging those inherent rights, because I know on the other hand, in the UK, the courts are currently handing out some of the most severe sentences to climate activists. So that's something that we really do have to address. They've really been severe for what I think is just our rights to free speech and to speak up for the planet. Young people and old people and everything in between are getting these severe sentences. So that's something we do have to address.
Yes. So the cases on protest that have been taking place in England made me reflect. I think that the general approach was to focus on the sentencing and criticizing the sentencing. But I think the issue was wider than that. I think that really I question from what I have become aware of, directives by judges, not allowing those prosecuted to talk about motives, and in particular, referring to the climate and the crisis as a motive with, you know, references to the IPCC reports and everything. I would consider that that is a little bit surprising if you think about history and how during the apartheid in South Africa, during the trials to people that were even involved in violent acts, it was allowed for them to explain their motives. So it's very peculiar that in this context, the stance has been taken that it is irrelevant or it shouldn't be heard. I mean, actually, it is up to the jury what it makes out of it. But what I find surprising is removing certain information as already decided that it's not relevant. I would imagine it is relevant. And I think that the quality of that trial could have been re-examined, and I didn't see any challenge to that.
Yeah, indeed. It's a form of self-defense, I would say. I think it's very related to that. And we have the right to defend ourselves or speak out against the injustice in our livelihood on this planet. You spoke there about your background. Of course, you're from Peru and your indigenous heritage. And some of the strongest of environmental defenders are those indigenous communities. But law is not often written in their languages or shaped by their worldviews. So how can international law be decolonized to truly reflect the rights of nature and indigenous peoples and not only just protect them through these foreign frameworks?
Well, I think that one of the most developed systems to actually acknowledge indigenous rights under international law and understand those correct frameworks is the Inter-American system. Because of the reality of Latin America and the dispossession, and in the book, I really dig in into that, on a number of stories, the treatment that indigenous peoples have been afforded, this colonial idea. You may remember in chapter 3, I speak about people in isolation, voluntary isolation in the Amazon, and make a comparison with this big debate of Bartolomé de las Casas and Ginés de Sepúlveda during the colonial times. It was a debate that examined the attitude that Spain had towards indigenous peoples. And the question back then was whether indigenous peoples had soul. And Ginés de Sepúlveda was considering indigenous peoples like subhumans. And so that was the way how indigenous peoples were looked at by a colonial mind. I drew a parallel because the descriptions of destruction that Bartolomé de las Casas witnessed and wrote about run in parallel with a modern destruction, a modern dispossession that is massive. The case of the Wayuu with the coal mine that I was telling you at the beginning of this conversation, the Wayuu survived the colonial invasion of the Spanish, but they are hardly surviving today the dispossession that they are suffering and the contamination inflicted by three major fossil fuel companies. And they are all based in Europe. So that's a different way of colonization, of taking away and of denying the dignity of people and with them of their beliefs, nature, and of their right to exist together in their traditional lands. This is a very important topic running across the book. I discuss the international law that actually protects and gives the solutions for these apparent dichotomies. Even the idea that we have about progress or development, is it that indigenous peoples are against progress? In many of the stories, it is portrayed as if they are resisting progress. But what we are understanding is that are we, with all those projects that are highly destructive, are we speaking about that is progress? I mean, certainly it cannot be, because the example of the coal mine, the contamination there is causing diseases of all sorts, including cancer. The other day, I was just listening to some of the effects of, for example, Shell, the contamination of oil in Nigeria, and it's so deep. Women, for example, when they are conceiving babies, how it's affecting everything in Colombia, in the coal mine example as well. So this is really horrendous, the impact on the environment and people because they are within the environment. And I think that the law provides a clear answer to that. It is unlawful what is happening. So it is not so much about the lack of laws. The UN has developed very important frameworks. We have had already very important jurisprudence, very rich jurisprudence. When I did the Torres Strait Islanders case, which was about indigenous peoples, First Nations in Australia, and I had to argue the aspect of culture and how, because the islands were sinking, they obviously would not conceive themselves in their identity the same if they were to be removed from there. So for them, it's a no in terms of possibilities to live where they are based right now. The islands are their own identity. So to understand that connection to territory, to ancestral land, was very important. And not just that, but the notion of dignity. The notion of dignity that the Inter-American Court has developed through the right to life. So it's not enough to be alive. To have a proper protection of the right to life, it has to consider all these cultural aspects. If you cannot enjoy these aspects that form part of your dignity when it comes to culture, when it comes to the land that you have a strong ties with, then your dignity is breached. Then the proper sense of your right to life is violated. So this has been developed all on the basis of indigenous people's cases in the Inter-American system. And I brought it. Now the Human Rights Committee in its general comment on the right to life has picked up exactly that. And so we are having even a better understanding of ourselves via jurisprudence that has evolved from cases that were brought by indigenous peoples. So in other words, we have the law. What has been happening is a massive violation of the law. Why? Because powerful companies can. And that's what they've been doing. And my task in taking up some of these cases has been in redress that, because I believe that justice cannot be unequal, that access to courts have to be something that everybody should enjoy if one thinks that a right has been breached.
Yes, that's so important. And I'm just wondering, do you ever fear that the law moves too slowly for the pace at which the ecological systems are unraveling? Because at this stage, even those from the fossil fuel lobbies who now outnumber at the COP conferences, the activists and the legislators, I mean, we're all agreeing that something needs to be done, but they want to do it slower. They want to decelerate the change. And it's well and fine that we all agree, but it's not fine if we take action too late. So how can we really amp up and accelerate the changes and the just transition that needs to take place to ensure our planetary health, our human health, non-human animal health?
So first of all, we don't have time. You know, we don't have time for that kind of attitude. I think it's a big denial of what is going on. But some of the arguments when you had litigation that wanted action was to say, well, you know, but we still have 15 years. The island is not yet underwater. That is a totally nonsense approach because the changes can be very dramatic. We have just seen that in Switzerland, for example, when this mountain just came down, one of them was climate change and the fact that the glaciers were melting, which then interacted with other causes. And the mountain, you saw that it just destroyed the entire town. So there may be situations where states can respond fast to this kind of crisis, but others can't. Things can move very dramatically, very fast. And it's not because you don't see, you can say, well, it's far away, we still have time. What can we do? Certainly the UN has acknowledged that one of the most important catalysts for change has been court cases that average people, ordinary people has brought. So the changes and the action didn't come from the cops. It came actually from ordinary people going to courts and saying, this is happening, I want a solution. And that had public impact to the point that then further action has to come. I think that this is something that we have been observing and it is happening and it will continue to happen. And it's the only way things can be clarified, it seems, for companies and for states. I mean, not long ago, climate change was not even considered a human rights issue. Now that is undeniable. Where was that established? In court cases, in cases that were brought. But at the level of our own mentality, so beyond litigation and our own consciousness about what's going on, our role, one thing that we have to accept is that it is not about changing one system that is based on fossil fuels for another likewise system that is based on green energy. That is just impossible. Yeah, to think that you can just plug that change and things are going to be fine. Because look what we are doing with lithium, for example, or with rare minerals. So the idea that you can, instead of oil, use blah and have the same level of consumerism and that is going to be fine. The earth, as a lawyer, seeing what I see, is already quite depleted. That's why now people want to go to mine the deep sea. Because if you go for rare minerals that are wanted by particularly tech, because people buy a mobile phone every year or every 2 years, that is about consuming or buy clothes that they were going to throw away, you know, in a couple of years. Do you know where all these rare elements that maybe require and needed to actually get a mobile phone come from? Do you think it's indefinite that we can get that from the earth? No. And so the same happens with many other matters that we just take for granted, that we just feel entitled to that level, you know, particularly tech and how much we rely on that. So we are not going to have the same energy, the same power. We don't need that. So things have to be adjusted. And I think a more sustainable style of life has to develop and people have to be more conscious about that. And now I'm seeing that, you know, in communities, there's a lot of repair cafes now People don't want to throw things. People want to have a different style of life where you are not pushed just as a consumer, but you are an individual that appreciates and don't want to have nature destroyed because of your insatiable hunger for buying things.
Yeah, that are completely unnecessary. And you've critiqued the Paris Agreement, important to have, but binding, but unenforceable. You know, it resonates to so many climate advocates who are really frustrated by its impotence. And you're filling that gap through litigation. But are we at risk of building this patchwork of precedents rather than a cohesive, enforceable international legal regime is really demanded and needed to push forward change in a timely manner?
Well, the Paris Agreement is fundamental. So the Paris Agreement set the obligations. So the substantive law there is binding. The issue was not that the Paris Agreement was unclear or soft. No, the issue was that they had not enforcing mechanism. So the Paris Agreement is being a crucial treaty to be able to interpret in a new light other treaties. And that's what has happened. But I don't think that that is leading us to a fragmented regime. On the contrary, it's filling the gaps and it's being a more cohesive regime. During the proceedings interpreting the Convention on the Law of the Sea, questions were asked whether the Convention on the Law of the Sea went farther when it came to the protection of the environment. The answer was yes. And it's good that it is so, because it is a treaty that focuses particularly on the law of the sea. So the impact on the Paris Agreement to accept, for example, that GHG emissions is a form of pollution, that which was acknowledged by the International Tribunal for the Law of the Sea, is a major achievement that then leads to understanding then what are the obligations of the states, how can we protect better the sea? And we know that the sea is 70% of our earth. So that is where crucial battles are being fought for the future of humanity, for the future of the earth. So many species at stake there. So I don't see the fact that different courts are dealing with different bits and aspects of the law is problematic. What I see is actually the opposite. I see that there is a lot of communication there, and not just at the level of international courts. Also, I'd say that domestic cases are being followed very, very closely. So the gaps are being filled. I mean, this recent case concerning the Peruvian farmer in Germany, concerning RWE, which set very important precedents and clearly set the precedent that corporate actors can be held accountable for their contribution to the pollution that is causing the melting of glaciers and generally other types of pollution in the context of climate change. So the fact that now that can be transboundary, because RWE was not having a subsidiary acting in situ, physically in Peru, and yet it was accepted by the court that those actions were transboundary harm, in principle, could hold said company liable for its contribution. So that's a huge principle that came, you know, in the context of a specific litigation. So I'm actually seeing a development. There's a lot of communication among different rationalities, reasonings, and I see that as something positive.
Hi, my name is Luke Collins, and I'm a student at the University of Texas at Austin, studying philosophy and interdisciplinary liberal arts. I want to take a moment to tell a quick story that I think echoes Barrister Feria Tinta's wonderful points. Last fall, I worked for an environmental nonprofit here in Austin, and one morning I was asked to attend the Texas Railroad Commission. Put simply, the Railroad Commission regulates and issues permits to oil and gas operations across the state. And I remember how rapidly the three commissioners began voting. I arrived early, and it was 9 a.m. sharp when the blitz started, one approval after another, and it seemed, indeed, I was told, that they'd already decided which permits to pass and which to deny. When prominent items came up, the tempo was interrupted by testimony. When the testimony expressed concern for the environment, without fail, the commissioners either paid no attention or claimed that us environmentalists were ignorant of the quote-unquote facts. Now, after an hour or so, a West Texas rancher stood up. He strode toward the podium and let something heavy slam the pretty wood. It was, I soon found out, a water bottle full of concrete. Now, Texas law requires companies plug their unused wells with a thick concrete cap to prevent leftover crude from contaminating the surrounding soil and water. This specific concrete cap, he said, was poured so recklessly that it never dried properly. So he had gone out, scooped it up, and brought to the commission. As a result, oil was spilling onto his property endangering his animals and endangering the welfare of his family, and he simply wanted the laws in the books to be properly enforced. Now, at this point, I half expected that the commissioners, all of whom also came from West Texas, would genuinely engage this aggrieved man, but not so. They simply repeated that they'd plugged more wells that year than ever before. So the rancher walked gingerly back to his seat, unconcerned with the cement dust that had settled on the podium. As Faria Tinta has discussed, the law is only as powerful as the authority that enforces it. For me, the rebuffed cowboy raised this question. If enforcers refuse to enforce existing law, how do we hold them accountable? Faria Tinta emphasizes this issue. While a robust environmental law regime is essential to fighting climate change, it isn't the whole story. As she notes, consumerism, extraction, and depletion won't simply vanish along with oil and gas, just as the railroad commissioners' interests don't necessarily conform to the spirit of the law they're tasked with enforcing. The rancher's cement-filled bottle sits heavy in my memory. It's a tangible reminder that real environmental progress requires not just legal frameworks and not just enforcement mechanisms within those frameworks, but the political will to trigger those enforcement mechanisms. Until we address the institutional barriers that prevent enforcement, the environmental laws in places like, at least Texas, may remain as ineffective as concrete that never properly set. Now, back to the interview.
Yes, it's important, and I like to see those other mechanisms for really enforcing it, which is essential piece of the puzzle. And so, you know, there's a lot of fire in you, and I wonder who you attribute that to, what teachers or mentors or parents and your whole support group that instilled those values in you and your desire to make change in the world.
Oh, that's a good question about teachers. Well, I have a very good teacher, a naturalist, Clemens Felder, who patiently really, I think, started showing me and teaching me about nature, because I grew up in a city, Lima. I was disconnected mentally, I think, from nature, to be honest. And I never paid attention. I was focused on other things. But there were obviously aspects. Obviously, I was very connected to the sea, having lived all my life in a coastal city. I feel at home when I'm by the sea. And I have a deep love for the sea as a consequence. I think it's very powerful. Anyone that has lived by the sea would know that. I need to smell it, I need to see it, I need to feel it. But my partner, Clemens Felder, is from the mountains. He came from Austria. He used to climb mountains, he studied forestry. So he had a very good knowledge, and he started teaching me, like going for walks and then telling me the different species that we saw. We got into birds. I think the birds bit was because of my own migration and understanding all of a sudden that birds made these unbelievable voyages, you know, seasonally to survive. And then the respect came, because it's unbelievable how tiny little birds did the most heroic trips, of which we were not aware even. And yet they arrived at a certain time and they survived. So in my life, I started receiving lessons from nature directly, all sorts of lessons. You see resilience, you see fallen trees that start growing again. And when you see yourself fallen, you know, and you see yourself suffering or etc., then you look at nature and you see how persistent and how of renewal everything is. And then you also see yourself as capable of that. So every single lesson by nature gave me that power, that ability to see how you were part of that and you could also do that. You know, the most humble things. Or water is capacity. My mother told me when I was little that she observed where she grew up that water can pierce stones. And I thought, well, it can. I mean, you wouldn't imagine that, but it does. And what does that mean? That means that persistence can create a change. And I think that really is somewhere there, because I needed to be persistent in my work. And I have learned that from nature, from what my mother taught me, she observed in nature.
And what kind of person were you like as a young girl, as a young person growing up?
Oh, so I'm left-handed. When I was little, I had speech problems. I probably am a little bit autistic, because I can't concentrate for hours and hours and for 14 hours. I can work 14 hours nonstop. And I realized that that's not what everybody else does. So little by little, I've realized that in that sense, I'm a little bit different. So I like books since I was little. My mother has had to force me to play in the fresh air. I studied music quite early. She gave me the opportunity to study music when I was 6. I think that was an important happening in my life because it connected me with harmony. And I think that harmony hasn't abandoned me. So when things appear very dark or very challenging, I always go back to music. And music always tells me that everything is going to be fine, because if we are capable of creating that beauty, we are capable to resolve anything. So there is something essentially good that we are able to achieve. I think those have been important influences. I grew up in a country that lived through dictatorships. So yes, my upbringing was not the one of a child, let's say, in a country like the United Kingdom. I mean, I grew up observing great injustices, observing. We had a number of dictatorships. Most of my life has been under dictatorship back in my country of origin. First military dictatorships. Then I decided to be a lawyer. At 12, I wanted to be a lawyer. My speech issues had been resolved. And then I felt that we had a chance at the point, but then we had a civil war because Peru did not manage to resolve deeply divisive issues. And the civil war was a big challenge, I think, because I was studying in law faculty that we lived in a rule of law. But outside in the streets, people were being killed in a way that had no accountability. So these were things that affected me deeply as a person. And I think that that's where the sense of justice comes from. And I think it hasn't left me since. And I, for that reason, I also believe very strongly in the importance of the rule of law. So in my work in England, I'm very lucky to be working in a legal system that is very evolved. And for me, it's very important that every single person can access the rule of law across the world. So part of my work has to do with that as well, to provide remedies that we don't live in situations where major violations can happen with no consequences.
Yes, and you spoke about many important things there. One, the importance of education for educating engaged citizens. So if you could tell us about that, but also to the importance of music and the arts and inspiring us to want to protect that beauty we find in the world.
I think art is very important. Literature is very important. Why? Because it takes you from your ego and it helps you to develop empathy. To develop empathy is very important because it's like to be in the shoes of something else or someone else. So if you can think like a bird or you can think like a flower, you start seeing things from someone else's perspectives. It's extremely important because otherwise we are in the best way that this German word is so precise, no, Selbstsüchtig. You know, it's all about ourselves. I mean, that can be extremely dangerous because it can give us a distorted idea of things and an image of the world. So I think literature, art helps us making sense of things, but also breaking the barriers of just looking at things from one single angle, which is our own personal angle. I think that's why it enriches our lives and it opens doors. I mean, I owe so much to reading because that's what opened my horizons and I started to understand the world and also develop this empathy for people and for other realities that I was myself not experiencing. So it is definitely necessary in our lives. And it's a place where we go back often, don't we, for life? Because it's a collective endeavor. I mean, art is not isolated. I mean, we all participate in a dialogue. It's where we reflect. Look, I mean, I did all these law cases, etc., but it seems that it was not enough. There was so much there. And I needed to convey that somewhere. And I found the medium of actually writing stories that were beyond the law, that had to do with assimilating things and reflecting things. I think it was a process. From the time when I started writing the book to the time when I finished, I realized that there had been so many things going on that only then, when putting it on paper, I realized what had happened. So that's part of our condition as human beings. We live and then it's only after we live that we can see the full dimension of what happened.
Yeah, it's important that we can examine and our role in it and then find new ways forward and restore our energy for going forward. The good fight is never over. And, you know, we're a project that has the participation of over 100 universities and a lot of young people are feeling this eco-anxiety. So as you think about the future, the kind of world we're leaving the next generation, what would you like young people to know, preserve and remember?
I like young people to know that they are extremely powerful. So I'm one person, but I always had this positive idea about my role. And you cannot let anyone tell you what limitations are there. So you shouldn't feel limited by anyone telling you this is as far as you can go and this is what you can do. I think only you know about that. And I think you start step by step. You just take the first step. I think when I did the first case, I learned some things. Then it was the next case. When it came the time to learning, learn with all your might, because that's gold. It's a moment in life when you have the time to actually do that. And you should do that. You shouldn't be lazy. Read, get informed, get pleasure out of learning, because learning is very important. So open up and don't let being guided just by some type of searches, you know, the people that are into Googling everything. Open up your searches, go out there, learn in a different way, be creative about how you learn. That's where it starts. I started all my basics with my professors. I use all my opportunities, although I was challenged in opportunities arriving to the UK as a refugee. When I learned all of that, and I did take the time to read absolutely every judgment that was in the syllabus, you know, then everything started making sense in the mind. And then you make new connections. And then it's where the wonderful ideas come from and the new perspectives and your contribution to a field. So I think actually that process is wonderful. And I guess the book was about giving hope, because I realized how much we could do together. If a person can manage to argue blah, 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 and make a major impact in the way we are understanding treaties and human rights or others, imagine what could be if every single person is in its own place, in its own field, contributing with that alertness and synced in the same way. I believe that the ordinary people are the ones that are bringing the changes here. I believe that the communities that are gathering together, for example, I'm seeing that in this country around the protection of rivers, is the communities that are going to mark the change. It's not going to come from up, it's going to come always from down up. And that means all of us, we have all a role. So to the young people, I would say, you have the right of joy and you have the right to be happy. And working for the protection of what we love the most will make you happy. So get into a positive mindset, learn all what you can, be part of things that make you feel positive. You will see how you will find your way. And there is no place for feeling you disempowered. This is the moment where you should feel very powerful, because it's us who are going to make the future of this earth.
Yes. Well, thank you, Monica Ferrier-Tinta, for being a barrister for the earth, sharing your warrior spirit, these cases of hope for our future, for defending planetary health, human rights, and this humanistic vision for the betterment of all. Indeed, we're not separate from nature. We're all one with nature, and we all live on one planet we call home. Thank you for adding your voice to One Planet Podcast and the creative process.
Thank you. It was lovely to speak to you.
The Creative Process and One Planet Podcast is supported by the Jan Michalski Foundation. This interview was conducted by Mia Funk with the participation of collaborating universities and students. Associate interview producers on this episode were Sophie Garnier and Luke Collins. One Planet Podcast is produced by Mia Funk with additional production support by Katie Foster. Theme music is written and performed by Juan Sanchez. We hope you've enjoyed this program. If you'd like to get involved in One Planet Podcast and be part of the climate change solution, just follow us on Instagram @Creative Process Podcast and send us a DM. Thank you for listening.